Wish I was a mole in the ground. Wish I was a mole in the ground. 'Cause if I was a mole in the ground, I'd tear those mountains down.
Good morning. You are tuned to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM on the air and KBOO.FM on the web. This is the Old Mole Variety Hour, and I'm your host today, Joe Clement. The Old Mole is a political magazine for your ears. The kind of politics we espouse are hard to pin down. Socialist, feminist, democratic, ecological, anti-racist, and anti-capitalist. We showcase the struggles of ordinary people, the psychology of social life and oppression, direct and collective action, and the threats to and promises of this world. Week to week, we offer interviews, movies and book reviews, commentaries, readings, and music. Today's show will start out with Bill Resnick and Tara DeMant of Amnesty International on the surprisingly underreported support for refugees in the United States. Following that, Bill Resnick will read a bit of something from Rebecca Solnit's book, A Paradise Built in Hell, about the generosity of ordinary working people. Following Bill, well-read Red, Fran Michel, will discuss the history of Vamport, the need for public housing, and the importance of solidarity rather than individualism in social provisioning. In the latter half of the show, Desiree Heligers shares field recordings from Anacortes, Washington, where she was part of the recent protest against fossil fuels and imperialism. And to conclude the show, I'll be talking about one of the original Smurf comics that offers a cautionary tale about money and so-called financialization. You are listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. Listen to us again and share segments that we put up on the KBOO website by going to kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour. You can follow us on Facebook or Twitter to get updates about when we get the show posted, or email us at oldmolevarietyhour@gmail.com to get on our mailing list. Now, here's Bill Resnick and Tara DeMant talking about refugees. Bill?
Thanks, Joe. Tara DeMant, welcome to KBOO.
Thanks for having me.
Tara DeMant works in the leadership of the organization Amnesty International USA. Her specialty is women's rights, LGBT rights, children's rights, and also what we talk about today, refugee and migrants' rights. Last week, Amnesty International released a survey of people all over the world. They called it the Refugees Welcome Index. As to the U.S. part of the survey, they found, and this is what's surprising for many of us, that the vast majority of people in this country, 71%, would welcome more refugees into this country. And 63% said the U.S. government should do more to help refugees. Tara DeMant, why don't you tell us about Amnesty International just for a minute, and then tell us about the survey, why you did the survey, and its findings.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me. So Amnesty International is a grassroots human rights organization founded in 1961. We're a Nobel Prize-winning organization that works for human rights for all people, including refugees and people on the move, of course. We have members all over the world and in every state here in the United States, and we work collectively to make sure that all people can access their human rights through reporting, through advocacy, through lobbying, and through community organizing. So we launched this global survey because we were really concerned with the media we'd been seeing, particularly here in the United States, but in other places, that really played up anti-refugee sentiment and played on the fears that people may have on people on the move and refugees. What we found is that globally, almost without exception, that people feel compassion and concern for refugees, and they don't want to turn their backs on people fleeing war and horrific violence. So what this means is a lot of press, and here in the United States is a great example of that, is totally out of step with the way that actually average Americans or average people around the world feel about refugees and what they're willing to do for refugees.
And you did this study in how many countries? Something like 30, it appeared to me.
Yeah, this was in 27 countries, including the United States.
Uh-huh. And how do you make sense of this, what's so divergent from what we see in the press? It seems to me there are so many groups and people that are and around the world that make a living by and tie their political futures to immigrant bashing. How could they be successful in a world where, in fact, most people are sympathetic to immigrants and often generous and wish their countries would do more?
Yeah, that's exactly right. And those were the findings, that most people, the vast majority of people, 73%, believe people should be able to take refuge in other countries. A vast overwhelming majority believe that they should be able to take refuge in that country, in that very country that they're living in, right? So, you know, one of the things in the United States, if we think about, is that, you know, oftentimes our press covers not average people and actually the sort of sentiment of people, but politicians. And here in the States, politicians, particularly in Congress, and then, you know, people seeking elective office, who are trying to block refugees, are totally out of step. And they're doing it because fear-mongering motivates people. So this anti-refugee sentiment and anti-immigrant and anti-migrant sentiment plays to our basest fears. And we've seen that be successful in U.S. politics before, frankly, right? After World War II and internment, and then during World War II and the turning away of Jewish refugees. So we've seen these types of fears have devastating consequences, even when average people don't believe that we should turn our backs on refugees. So I think part of that coverage is because we're covering politicians and the way that they're trying to use messaging to gain political gain as opposed to actually representing the average person's belief about refugees and the average person's compassion.
Yeah, and the fear-mongering. What you're saying, though, is that people both have sympathy for refugees, want to help them, particularly people like the actively helping individuals. I'll be reading something from a book on disaster, what happens in disasters. The official government often flees, and ordinary people help one another. On the other side, though, people really can be panicked and do things that they would never do if they thought about it, and in fact can be panicked into voting for politicians who are going to save them from this horrific actions by terrorists, refugees. How do we deal with that? Because people are of two minds. They can be frightened. It seems to me we have to sort of, and we really have to control the narrative and or shape the narrative. I gather you're also in the business of trying to shape the narrative.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, one of the things that we do with our work on refugees and migration here in the United States is we do a lot of education, and this isn't just like to the quote-unquote average person. We do a lot of education to Congress as well, which is talking about what the resettlement process here is in the United States for refugees. So I think that, you know, when there's a terrorist attack and people see these attacks and they respond with fear and they're concerned about security, being concerned about a security doesn't mean you have to be anti-human rights, right? Those things can go together. And in fact, when security policy is motivated by human rights, it makes us safer. And when we instead act on fear and misinformation, it doesn't make us safer. So in the United States, a refugee goes through a two-year process, which includes 14 different security checks, starting with the UN all the way through the Department of Homeland Security, ICE, the FBI. I mean, there's multiple checks. So refugees coming into the United States are the most vetted human beings that come to the United States. No other person who comes into the country is as vetted as refugees. And that basic fact is not something people actually really know. And this includes people who are making laws about refugees, which is really disturbing, right? So part of what we do is try and educate people on how important it is that we speak about human rights while we speak about security, and then also how secure that process already is. The other thing we want to talk about, right, is that refugees are themselves fleeing that horrific violence that we see when we see terrorist attacks, when we see war, and when we see armed groups attacking. That's why refugees are fleeing. They are the people who are trying to escape from that. And so making sure that when we're having those national conversations about conflict and terrorism, that we're not lumping in the groups of people who are just like us, trying to make sure they live lives of dignity and safety. So part of that is just education. The other thing, though, is to make sure that we all, no matter where we're sitting, don't feel like we're powerless in this. And I think that when there's reporting in the press, when there's a politician, when your own elected official or someone who'd like to become your elected official is speaking up and using anti-refugee rhetoric, it can be very disempowering. And to hear that, particularly when we as human beings feel compassion, and with, you know, 63% of Americans want our own government to do more to help refugees, that we take that opportunity to speak up to make sure that the only narrative being heard isn't this anti-refugee rhetoric, because it is in the minority. And when we don't speak up, then it can sound like it's the majority, and it's not. So I'd really encourage us all to make sure that when we hear anti-refugee rhetoric, we write our letters to the editor, we call into our radio stations, we speak to our friends and neighbors, that we continue that conversation around how we welcome refugees, how Americans want us to welcome more refugees.
This is Bill Resnick for the Old Mole Variety Hour here on KBOO in Portland, Oregon. I'm talking to Tara DeMont. We're coming to the end of the interview. You know, when I think about refugees and migrants, I think about both now, the terrible wars in the Middle East, and refugees all over the world. It's now, we're setting world records for the number of people on the run from various places, including global warming, including very brutal wars and brutal dictatorships. Some of it, though, is the product of the refugees do not generally want to leave their country. Most people, in fact, find their country to be a place that they want to live in. It seems to me that U.S. foreign policy also is, it's really important to get involved in attempting to reduce the kinds of conflicts and the global warming problems that lead to refugees. I'm sure you agree with that. I'm not sure, though, that Amnesty International can intervene in those struggles. You have your hands full with all of the others. But why don't you comment for a second?
Sure. I mean, as you've noted, right, that these are intersectional issues, so that when any government is engaged in external affairs or work abroad, that making sure that that work is focused in human rights principles and then actually is tested, and there's, you know, the data to make sure that we're doing things well as a country or individual country is doing good human rights work that has positive impact. And that, I think, particularly is important not only in our aid and development and thinking about, you know, climate change, but really in our security and, you know, our security and anti-terrorism work. Like, what is that work? How do we lead forward for our own country to make sure that the policies we have, the actions that we take, don't actually cause human rights violations, right? And don't cause massive immigration and refugee crises, don't cause further violations of human rights. And that, you know, it can feel like there's short-term gain there, but the long-term loss is exactly what you've pointed to, is that when we've done this as a country without thinking about human rights, we suffer the consequences later, and ultimately people, like, their real lives are impacted by a lack of human rights. And so that's always the policy that we're pushing for as Amnesty International, is for every country, including here in the United States, to lead with human rights, whatever that policy focus is, whether it's responding to a refugee crisis or preventing one from happening, so while, as we move forward with security measures.
That's great to hear, actually. I didn't realize that Amnesty International was also involved and taking the risk of talking about foreign policy and apparently critiquing lots of aspects of what the U.S. is doing. Sarah DeMont, thanks so much for talking to us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Right. So long. I guess I am on again. I want to talk about issues of human nature. You just heard Tara DeMont of Amnesty International. We discussed the surprising, though not so surprising, survey finding that 71% of U.S. North Americans would welcome more refugees and think the U.S. should do much more for refugees. That's not surprising, though, when you think about the generosity and decency and fellow feeling of most people. Reading about the survey and then preparing the interview with Tara DeMont, I began thinking about other, quote, surprising findings that contradict the conventional wisdom on human nature, which is that the species is basically selfish, competitive, at best tribal, and unsympathetic and indeed fearful of strangers, that we resort to violence, war, and murder when our interests are challenged. And in this view, the only way to control and minimize that behavior is strict laws, police, quick and sure punishment, and constant teachings of lessons about when violence is wrong and when it is right, of course. And this dozen view is then promoted and confirmed in the theories of evolutionary biologists, and especially the worst of them, establishment economists. But this dismal view of quote, human nature is contradicted by a great deal of evidence, an immense amount of evidence. In fact, most people are never violent. Many societies never go to war. Many early societies have deep cultural demands and values to welcome and assist strangers and travelers. Tens of thousands of people risk their lives to save Jews and gypsies and gays and communists from the death camps during Second World War. People willingly suffer pain for others when they register to donate bone marrow for leukemia patients unknown to them, for example. And there are popular websites where volunteers donate one of their kidneys for transplantation into a stranger. Less spectacular, but perhaps even more important for our coexistence, are the innumerable situations in daily life that do not conform to the image of the always egocentric human race. Why, for example, and these are just small examples, do we leave a tip even when we know we will never return to the restaurant? Why do we rush to stop a child we see running into the streets? It's difficult to see the advantage of caring for a bedridden relative for years, or giving an anonymous donation to help earthquake victims we don't know, or volunteering our precious time for a good cause, as more than 70 million Americans do each week. Another example, I've always been struck by studies of giving to the poor, particularly face-to-face when asked for help. Poor people, much more often than the rich, give help when requested. There, but for the grace of God, go I. As to the well-to-do, they hardly ever give, and in fact ignore those requests. One final example, the behavior of people in crisis when faced with life and death questions. Here I'm going to read from Rebecca Solnit's wonderful book, A Paradise Built in Hell. In one passage, she discusses Hurricane Katrina. Here is Solnit. Thousands of people survived Hurricane Katrina because grandsons or aunts or neighbors or complete strangers reached out to those in need all through the Gulf Coast and because an armada of boat owners from the surrounding communities and as far away as Texas went into New Orleans to pull stranded people to safety. Hundreds of people died in the aftermath of Katrina because others, including police and vigilantes, some high government officials and the media, decided that the people of New Orleans were too dangerous to allow them to evacuate the septic drowned city or rescue them, even from hospitals. Some who attempted to flee were turned back at gunpoint or shot down. Rumors proliferated about mass rapes, mass murders, mayhem that turned out later to be completely untrue. Though the national media and New Orleans police chief believed and perpetuated those rumors during the crucial days when the people were dying on rooftops and elevated highways and in crowded shelters and hospitals in the unbearable heat, without water, food, medicine, or medical attention, those rumors led soldiers and others dispatched as rescuers to regard victims as enemies. Solnit goes on, beliefs matter. Though as many people act generally despite their beliefs as the reverse. Katrina was an extreme version of what goes on in many disasters, wherein how you behave depends on whether you think your neighbors or fellow citizens are a greater threat than the havoc wrought by disaster, or a greater good than the property and houses and stores around you. What you believe shapes how you act. How you act results in life and death for yourself or others, as in everyday life, only more so. Katrina was, like most disasters, also marked by altruism of young men who took it upon themselves to supply water, diapers, protection to the strangers stranded with them, of people who rescued or sheltered neighbors, of the uncounted hundreds of thousands who set out in boats armed, but also armed with compassion to find those who were stranded in the stagnant waters and bring them to safety. In the wake of an earthquake or bombing or major storm, most people are altruistic, urgently engaged in caring for themselves and those around them, strangers and neighbors as well as friends and loved ones. The image of the selfish, panically or regressive, savage human being in times of disaster has little truth to it. I think I'm going to conclude there. We're going to talk more about Rebecca Solnit's wonderful book, A Paradise Built in Hell by her. We'll do that another time. In any event, people are compassionate towards refugees. They're compassionate for one another. The kinds of behaviors that we are so immersed in media and other places, of brutality and selfishness, that really isn't human nature. It's the product of the various social conditions that we live in. This is Bill Resnick for The Old Mole.
Thanks, Bill. I'm Joe Clement, your host for The Old Mole Variety Hour. Up next, we're going to turn to Well-Read Wren, Fran Michelle, who's going to be discussing a bit of history about Vamport. You heard about the Vamport Mosaic Festival, now hear about Vamport. And she's also going to be talking about public housing and the importance of solidarity rather than individualism in social provisioning. Fran?
Coming up this weekend, May 27th through May 30th, the Vamport Mosaic Festival is a commemoration of the 68th anniversary of the Vamport flood. KBOO is a supporter of these 4 days of lectures, performances, screenings, exhibits, and other events. Built during World War II to house workers in the shipyards, Vamport became, for a time, the second largest city in Oregon, with its own schools, daycare, hospital, shops, and movie theater. Although it was built with federal funds and after Roosevelt's executive order prohibiting racial discrimination in defense industries and government, local officials enforced housing segregation on the basis of race. Still, Vamport was far more racially diverse than redlined Portland or the rest of exclusionary Oregon. The state's first black teachers and police were hired here. Its schools were integrated, and the Vamport Interracial Council worked to establish a Portland office of the Urban League. The buildings were flimsy, the location was marshland, and it was all swept away when the dikes holding back the Columbia River broke on Memorial Day, 1948. But among its other lessons, Vamport shows what is possible when a housing emergency is taken seriously. It was the largest federal housing project of the time. Of course, other places have more extensive and successful histories with public housing. In the U.S., public housing goes back to the 19th century with the development of alternatives to New York City tenements. As Matthew Gordon Lasner described it recently in The Nation magazine, quote, nonprofit subsidized housing was just as important as strong building codes in making cities livable. Some of the housing was developed and managed by organizations set up by single benefactors. Other complexes were built by joint stock companies and designed to allow larger numbers of smaller investors to participate. Yet others were owned and sometimes built by the tenants themselves on a nonprofit consumers cooperative basis, often with the support of trade unions. Along the way, local and state governments started to support private nonprofit housing with property tax abatements and long-term lowest-interest construction loans. End quote. Such programs grew more dramatically during the Depression, and in 1937, the U.S. Housing Act established the Housing Authority and provided funding to states for, quote, the provision of decent, safe, and sanitary dwellings for families of low income, end quote. Today, in Northern Europe, in larger cities, between 20% and 60% of housing is still publicly funded. There are often no income ceilings, so many upwardly mobile families choose to stay in their apartments. But in the U.S., Lasner points out, quote, the public housing program survived less than 40 years. Such was hostility to the idea and to the disenfranchised African Americans whom housing subsidies increasingly served. Initially, public housing drew a mixture of families, white and black, poor and working class. Many were upwardly mobile. But as mass suburbanization relieved pressure on city housing markets, those who could afford to do so left. Congress, pressured by builders to fund only housing that would not compete with the private market, forced cities to economize on construction, compounding the problem. End quote. The devaluing of black lives and poor lives has contributed to a reluctance to support shared investments in social goods like housing, like education, like healthcare. That reluctance fits just fine with the interests of those profiting from the current system of political economy. Indeed, it has been cultivated by those who share the interests of capital, and it's been supported by a long ideological campaign to persuade us of Margaret Thatcher's famous dictum that there's no such thing as society. Builders and developers don't want subsidized housing or anything else driving down their profits. As Friedrich Engels pointed out in his writing on housing under capitalism, all the sermons of liberals and reformists preached to capital about profitability of low-cost housing are a waste of time. Capital has ignored the mass housing field because greater profits are to be made elsewhere, and profits, not human need, are the sole criteria of whether capitalism produces. And of course, capitalism has produced housing in Portland. It's produced very expensive housing. but in the interests of our collective social well-being, we need to work on enacting the recommendations of the recent Portland City Club report on housing, endorsed also by the editorial board of Street Roots. Quote, "The City Club committee recommends multiple solutions to change course. These include securing dedicated federal funding to create more affordable housing, setting aside city funds to purchase foreclosed and discounted properties during economic downturns, and updating the city's zoning code to foster more infill development. But among the most immediately impactful is the committee's call for lifting the state preemption of rent control. Rent control and similar stabilization measures are banned in Oregon, while no-cause evictions that clear buildings are allowed." End quote. Stopping no-cause lease terminations that give renters little control over their living situations, replacing them with a just-cause eviction law similar to Seattle's, as well as controlling the massive rent increases we've been seeing, are two ways to start saving people's lives. The dike has been breached. The flood is here. Surely, again, we can recognize and help our neighbors. For the Old Mole Variety Hour, this has been Fran Michelle.
We came up from the Southlands with the weight of being poor. I got a job at the Kaiser shipyards, building weapons for the war. We moved to Vanport City, to a brand new company home. It wasn't much, but it was a place to call our own. It's a place that we call home. Beneath layers of silt and mud, we've been washed away by the Vanport flood. That dirty Vanport, we've been washed away by the Vanport flood. That dirty Vanport flood.
You are listening to KBOO Portland. I'm your host, Joe Clement, for the Old Mole Variety Hour. That was the Louis Longmire Band singing Vanport 1948 from their Tales from the Left Coast Roasters album. And before that, we heard Fran Michelle bringing us a little bit of history about the Vanport flood, but also connecting it to the broader struggle for the housing that was really kind of the essence of that tragedy. It's what drew everybody out into that part of this region, and it is still a persistent problem that we have today. We have seen such a massive flight of people of color from Portland, and the people that are coming in are not only white, but they have a lot more money than the people going out. Up next, we're going to now turn to Desiree Heligers in the first of a two-part expose that she's doing. She was up in Anacortes, Washington about a week ago, where you may have heard that there was a chi-activist-themed, inspired protest of the fossil fuel industry. In particular, there's an oil refinery up there, and they were blocking some of the traffic going into there. She collected field recordings from activists and different people speaking to why they were there. Here's Desiree.
This past week, a global wave of actions under the banner of Break Free saw thousands of people protesting and blockading resource extraction, with waves of accompanying arrests on six continents. As actions unfolded in the United States, from Albany, New York, and Washington, D.C., to Denver and Los Angeles, more than 1,000 activists converged on Anacortes, Washington, to confront the role of big oil in rising global temperatures and sea levels, and to disrupt the flow of oil to the Shell and Tesoro refineries. On Friday, as cars, trucks, and vans arrived at the kayak hub just blocks away from Padilla Bay in Anacortes, I spoke with Gregory Sortier, an activist and substitute teacher from Portland who is helping with the gear.
I've been an environmental activist since the late 70s when I started to work for Greenpeace in high school. In the past few years, I've become part of the chi-activist movement that was born in the Pacific Northwest, primarily to take on Shell Oil in their Arctic drilling scheme. Right now, I'm primarily working in a support capacity with the Backbone Campaign, who is organizing this great flotilla event.
Yeah, so talk a little bit. You're a substitute teacher. Do you mind talking about some of that?
I've been a teacher now for about 15 years. I primarily did most of my teaching in Los Angeles, 8th grade English in inner city L.A. I also did a lot of activism in Los Angeles around oil companies, toxic waste, cement plants. burning toxic waste, and a variety of other things. I still am working with the World Resisters League in Portland to outreach to students on issues of militarism and increased violence of our military and other militaries around the planet. Oil is a strategic product. It's a strategic product, which means that we will use our military force to defend oil companies around the planet. And anybody who's been awake for the past 20 or 30 years knows that that reality is true. Not just in Iraq, but going all the way back to, you know, Shell's action in Angola, for example, the Niger Delta, and a whole host of other areas as well. Exxon in Indonesia with their death squads, and then our pumping up of all these military weapons into Indonesia, which were used to decimate the Indonesian population during the 70s. Oil, as a substance, some people consider it to be the lifeblood of American industrial production. I think myself and many, many other people are realizing that this bargain that we've made with these huge corporations is negatively affecting every person in this country and also around the world. It's time for us to actually step back and say, why are we fighting wars for oil? Why are we allowing oil companies to continue to pollute our atmosphere, our water, our beautiful lands, and to oppress people in other countries? One of the beauties of kayaktivism is the mobility of the kayaks and the ability of a small ship to stop one of the largest destructive corporations on the planet today. That's one person taking action against a company that is so large it kind of defies imagination.
Friday afternoon, Swinomish Tribal member Shelley Vandiolo with the Community Alliance and Peacemaking Project and Native Studies Leadership Faculty at the Swinomish campus of the Northwest Indian College offered a brief introduction in cultural competence training to prepare non-Native participants for Saturday's Native-led Day of Action.
My good people, good friends, good relatives, thank you for being here on this day. Thank you for your commitment to the earth. Welcome to this place. I am Swinomish. We are Swinomish tribal members. And when we got the call to come out and join the organizations, and there are many that are involved in this important work to protect the earth, I couldn't say no. So I went to all my elders and I went to all our prayer people and I asked them to start praying for the safety of us all that are going to be standing in the face of adversity.
Shortly after the Swinomish cultural competency training, I ran into Portlander Antonio Zamora, and we spoke as kayaktivists continued to arrive from all around the region.
I bicycled from Seattle all the way to Deception Pass. Yeah, it was really difficult and strenuous. It was my first bicycle tour, and it was really beautiful just to appreciate the nature and also being a person who just like says, man, we got to take action or create dialogue with people. And along the way, you know, you just see how beautiful this our home planet is. It's just a good idea to have positive activism and ethical forward stance on something, you know. So rather than talk about it, be about it. And why I'm here is just it's an opportunity to engage a local community, which this community is linked to or part of a oil refinery. And it's like this oil refinery produces 47% of the oil, fossil fuel energy in the Northwest. So it just makes a lot of sense to come here with a message and share an opportunity of dialogue, not necessarily focus on it's all got to be the action, but more like how can we talk to more people about building a non-violent movement against the fossil fuel industry. No matter it's climate justice, Black Lives Matter, IOS and NAPA, housing justice, we all have to work together and make the world a more compassionate place.
I ran into Antonio again later on.
So what are you doing right now, Antonio?
After taking the kayak out there for water support, I came back and went in the backbone tent and started building a Zapatista flag in solidarity with the Zapatistas with the Break Free movement. I believe if we make a just transition, it's going to be a major win for indigenous movements like the Zapatistas, perhaps even the Rojava movement, because they're fighting a colonial war, and the war around the world from this empire it needs oil. And I really want to build this flag for the Zapatistas to embrace their struggle with this movement.
On Saturday, I spoke with Michael Kerrigan, Program Director for the Community Alliance of Lane County, and we sat and spoke outside of the tent at the center of the Kayaktivist Hub.
Have you been involved in some of the Kayaktivism before this?
Yeah, I went down to Coos Bay, it was last summer. We did an action down there, protesting. They want to put a pipeline going through Coos Bay, bringing fracked gas, and so
the Pacific Connector.
Yes, Pacific Connector. So we had a big action down there, though I wasn't able to take part in the Shell actions in Portland. But we got a great 350 group in Eugene's, very active, very focused, doing really good work. And being in a kayak, I just love being close to the water, and it just adds a special element to it. And also, I think it makes the connection between, you know, the water and the land. It's not just about protecting those of us in Eugene and Portland and the forest and the land, but also the sea, the oceans, the creatures who live in there. So it's a really powerful way to take action.
And you were out on the water last night with the Luminarium.
Yeah, holding the Luminarium was just, you know, great fun. Here we are in the middle of, you know, it's dark out, and there was a bunch of us holding signs. I wish I could see what we did. I'll check it out online, but it was just so creative and so much fun. And what I'm really enjoying about the weekend is the creativity of the people who are here. It's just like, I never could have thought of that. These, you know, signs that are, I don't know what kind of, you know, lights they were, but it was like magic.
Did you go down to the blockade on the rails at all?
I haven't been. I'm hoping to do that later. There's a large Eugene group there. And so I'm the backup police liaison for the group. And so I think I'm probably going to be called in to go and stay overnight.
Being in Portland, I can't help but think about Brian Wilson when I think about rail actions. Ryan is a testimony to kind of the recklessness of some of these corporations and the military when it comes to moving equipment on the rails, and that there's real risk involved in taking the rail.
And the bottom line for these companies and the military is their profits, moving things forward. So if someone loses their legs, so be it. So yeah, people... Are you know, risking life and limb doing that.
At dawn on Sunday, police arrived on the scene and began making arrests as protesters stood across the road chanting their support for as other protesters were being arrested.
No! I say oil train, you say no! Oil train!
No!
No oil trains!
No!
I say fossil fuels, you say no!
No!
Fossil fuels!
No!
Fossil fuels!
No!
Within a couple of hours, kayaktivists and supporters were busy at the activist hub downtown, preparing to take to the waters around the Shell and Tesoro refineries. There I ran into Lori King, longtime organizer with Portland Jobs with Justice, who is now retired.
How would you describe the scene this morning?
I would describe the scene this morning as full of people who are very compassionate about trying to make this planet a planet that we can all live on. And people are working very hard, working very collectively, dealing with just getting things done, like getting people coffee, getting people organized for both kayak action and dealing with people who were arrested. Just this morning on the tracks, there are people who are trying to stop oil trains from being able to deliver oil to the refinery. I'm also very concerned about the workers in the factory and workers in general. I'm really a union activist, and so I've been asking a lot of questions about what do the workers think, and what kind of jobs do people think of fighting for the workers. And I think that this whole movement has to be a two-pronged movement, and the same energy that goes into the desire to save the planet for everyone also has to be into a just transition with the same fervor, the same degree of planning. And we have to really figure out concrete ways to have a just transition. And I know there are workshops today on a just transition for the workers in Anacortes. So I'd be very interested in hearing the actual plans. I've talked to many, many workers, and if they had the choice, of course they'd rather do something that is not hurting themselves or the planet. The thing is that it isn't easy to find another well-paying job, and we environmentalists have to really deal with that in the most deep way and not just fluff it off.
Finally, I spoke with Allison Sosa, who was at the event with her two children, ages 3 and 6. I asked her what forms her activism takes.
My regional activism is I'm about 2 miles deep in about 4 different things. I do arts for people. I assist with that. Definitely worker in that sense. But as an organizer, I do work for Coal Terminal in Longview, trying to shut that down. I also am a member of the Mosquito Fleet. I remember talking about saving the planet when I was in kindergarten. Now my sons are in kindergarten, and our world is starting to see adverse effects at a rate faster than we can calculate. And academically, as an agriculture and hydrology student, I see what it should look like and what it really is looking like, and it's scaring me. So I'm not going to stand idly by. I'm not going to be afraid. I'm not going to ever say that something isn't worth my time, because that's all I have, and we're running out of it.
What have been some of the high points for you?
Driving up 20 and seeing my friends at the blockade, and then seeing...
And were your friends locked down?
Yeah. I haven't reached out to anybody yet, because they're doing their thing, and I trust that they will be fine. Chills thinking about it. Like, we did it. We're sending this message. This is it. This is no more. This is the red line in the sand. We're not gonna stand idly by. We really, really aren't. And that's the most inspiring thing.
You've been listening to the voices of activists participating in last week's Break Free event in Anacortes, Washington. This has been Desiree Helligers for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
Kids who populate these cul-de-sacs will never know what stood beneath their cookie-cutter houses. Fields and streams and woods, they'll sit in cars and wait for mom to drive them out of their...
You are listening to KBOO Portland. I'm Joe Clement, your host for the Old Mole Variety Hour. That was O Susquehanna, about the Susquehanna River in Pennsylvania, I believe, by Defiance Ohio from their Great Depression album. And before that, Desiree Helligers was bringing us field recordings from Anacortes, Washington, where environmental activists were protesting fossil fuel imperialism and trying to block both shipments coming down the rails and across the roads. And to finish up today's show, do y'all remember the Smurfs? In the late 1950s, Belgian cartoonist Pierre Culliford, known by the pen name Peyo, introduced Smurfs to the world. Many of us only really know the Smurfs through their second and third generation lives on TV, but they got their start in print. Peyo first wrote the Smurfs as supporting characters to another comic, Johan and Peewit, an adventuresome series set in medieval Europe. Then in the 1960s until the early 90s, he created 16 Smurf-specific comics. More would be written by other authors, taken into other mediums, and merchandised to Kingdom Come. There's a lot to be said about the Smurfs, but it's the last of Peyo's Smurf comics that I'd like to talk about today. Finance Smurf, written in 1992, right before Peo died, and translated into English in 2012, is naturally about financial wealth. It's not a rigorous social analysis, but more like a counter-narrative to economic myths about the origin of money and its social ramifications. Within these and other storytelling limits, Peo still makes sharp points about money as a pernicious way of managing social wealth that in practice gives rise to inequalities, antisocial behavior, and artificial scarcity. One day, Papa Smurf is knocked unconscious in a laboratory explosion. One of the Smurfs goes on a mission to get help from a local wizard, Homnibus. Homnibus figures out how to help Papa Smurf and sends his apprentice Oliver to a nearby town to get an ingredient he lacks. The unnamed Smurf accompanies him. Along the way, Oliver talks to the Smurf about money, as the missing ingredient has to be bought. And there's a cute moment of mutual alienation when both are surprised that the other lives with or without it. In town, they see people trade money for everyday goods, and there seems to be a constant conflict between buyers and sellers over prices. Oliver and the little Smurf see how people are divided between rich and poor, have and have not, consumers of luxury and consumers of charity. Even the little Smurf, who didn't know what money was, feels ripped off when a mere handful of hazelnuts costs 3 pence. Still, when leaving town, the Smurf is torn between skeptical bewilderment and intrigue. He decides he must tell Papa Smurf about it. When he gets back, Papa Smurf is beginning to recover, but is not well enough yet to have visitors. The Smurf decides not to wait, but instead to surprise Papa Smurf and the whole Smurf village with a money supply of coins and a plan to use them in a new money-based exchange economy. Before he makes his announcement, though, he needs a money supply. He, like all Smurfs, depends on other Smurfs. He goes to other Smurfs to do the work of sketching a design of the coin and making a sketch into a casting mold. He gets gold for the actual coins from Minor Smurf, who calls it useless junk and is actually helped by him taking it away. Handy Smurf, who has a forging furnace, pours the molten gold into the cast, and they both work on prying them out. The Smurf calls for a meeting of the whole village and, by an unexplained fiat, tells the Smurfs, quote, "From now on, like with the humans, Farmer Smurf will Smurf his wheat to earn his bread. Miller Smurf will Smurf flour to make some dough, and Baker Smurf will Smurf bread to earn his crust," end quote. Brainy Smurf objects, pointing out that Papa Smurf must weigh in on big village decisions, but the other Smurfs agree. To start them off, Finance Smurf, as they begin to call him, gives them all a bag of coins. Then, the way to get Smurfs otherwise is to work or make your money work for you, by loaning it out at interest. Finance Smurf, of course, gives himself a double portion. "And why's that?" one Smurf snaps. "Come on," Finance Smurf defends himself. "I had expenses. I had to Smurf all these coins. And it was my idea, wasn't it?" At first, Operation Money, as he calls it, seems to be working. Finance Smurf has to advise Smurfs about how to set prices, but before too long, everyone develops a habit for charging Smurfs for the things they do for or provide one another. This doesn't seem to cause any hard feelings, and actually comes off as a game until it comes time to eat dinner. And what was once an unconditional fact of living in the Smurf village is now only for those who can afford it. After a while, inequalities start to emerge as certain Smurfs accumulate money, while other Smurfs are unable to make money doing what they usually do for the village. Some Smurfs, especially those whose services is in the greatest demand, collect more than they know what to do with. Finance Smurf offers to hold this money for them, offer them a certain percentage of interest. He makes the money work. He invests it in new and needed things like a bridge, but the formerly open access and public bridge is now a toll bridge. Some Smurfs go so broke they have to beg for food from Smurfs who freely fed them before, and still others pay for everyday needs by taking out loans from Finance Smurf at interest and put up things like their bed and mushroom house for collateral. At one point, Finance Smurf starts to straight up convince them to sell their houses for bags of coins and then collect rent to stay there. All the while, Papa Smurf is still resting up from his accident. Then one day, the evil wizard Gargamel, the Smurf's main antagonist, discovers that the Smurfs have gold and begins to devise a plan to get it. This involves minting some fake coins, trapping one of the Smurfs, and holding them for ransom. It's at about this time that Papa Smurf begins to be well enough to move around and is only just starting to take note of the new economy when he's brought Gargamel's ransom note. He figures it's a trap and sends another Smurf to spy on him. The spy learns Gargamel does not plan to return the kidnapped Smurf, but to try and catch them all and their gold too. He curiously says that their greed will do them in. With this knowledge, the Smurfs reposition Gargamel's net. Then, when they meet him the next day, it's Gargamel who gets trapped, and they release the kidnapped Smurf and get back to the village. Life, it would seem, can go back to normal, but in the Smurf village, the new economic plan is causing other problems. Papa Smurf finally gets his share of gold coins, and after paying Smurfette for her unpaid care work, he's broke too. He asks Finance Smurf for a loan to rebuild his laboratory, but rejects Finance Smurf's terms when it requires him to charge his little Smurfs for help. Papa Smurf sees economic insecurity and compulsive productivity make the Smurfs aggressive and alienated, but also overly ingratiating towards Smurfs with money. Then a Smurf, maybe Grouchy Smurf, decides to leave the village and start life elsewhere. He's sick and Smurfed of it, he says, and the others follow, including Papa Smurf. At first, Finance Smurf is not too bothered. He now owns the whole town, but quickly he becomes too lonely to bear. He goes out and finds the Smurfs who left, recants monetizing the village, tells them that they don't owe him anything, and begs the Smurfs to return, which they do. When they have to do something with all the gold coins, they melt them down and make brass instruments, which are seen in the end making music for a community concert. The end. If you just tuned in, I'm Joe Clement for the Old Mole Variety Hour, and I've been talking about the last of the original Smurf comics, Finance Smurf. The Smurfs do not try to account for the whole economy, nor is it very clear how even the Smurfs' own village subsists. What they strike on, though, is the social life and psychology of money. The focus on money in this story might be taken as an ideological fixation on the realm of circulation, but labor is given special attention too, I think. The coins are almost entirely the product of other Smurfs' labor. The Smurfs withhold their labor as the only way out. Money, as a form of wealth, is shown to capture labor. Ultimately, it's not a revolutionary story, but a dystopian one, barely averted. It's like Ayn Rand's Gulch Gulch in Atlas Shrugged, except Rand thought she was writing heroic fiction. I recommend reading this with a five-year-old, asking them questions and trying to defamiliarize yourself with money. You are listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour. That was Nine Inch Nails with their classic 90s hit, Head Like a Hole. And before that, I was reviewing the last Smurf comic written by the original author, Finance Smurf. And that is all the time that we have for today's Old Mole. If you go to the website in a day or two, you'll be able to find any of the segments that you heard or listen to the whole show over again. That's kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour. I'd like to thank Bill Resnick and his guest Tamara DeMant for talking about refugees in the United States, to Fran Michelle for reviewing a bit of Vanport history and making a strong case for connecting that history to the need for public housing. I'd like to thank Desiree Helligers for her field recordings from Anacortes, Washington. Be sure to check in next week. There's going to be more material that she has from that she's going to be talking about. And you should go to counterpunch.org. It's an online magazine. Desiree just published an article on the Break Free movement titled From Redwood Summer to Break Free via Occupy. And thanks again to Peo for inventing the Smurfs.